I'm Julia Paskin. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. That's April 25th at the Crawford. Tickets at las.com/events.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us on this Tuesday. Got a jam-packed show, including the guys back with me for the triple play. Yeah, the Dodgers down 2-0 to the Atlanta Braves, but the series continues at Dodger Stadium. 2 o'clock this afternoon, we'll preview Game 3 and what we hope is a turnaround for the Dodgers. It'll be Abe Martinez and Nick Roman joining me. That's coming up a little bit later. But right now, we begin with our daily update on COVID-19. My pleasure to welcome back a guest who's been with us at least once a week for the past year and a half plus, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist, director of infectious disease and prevention at Pasadena's Huntington Hospital. Dr. Schreiner, very good morning to you.
Good morning to you too, Larry.
So let's talk about where we stand right now with looming FDA approval and looming likely CDC recommendation for boosters for both Moderna and Johnson & Johnson, and including multiple published reports that it's likely to be for mix and match boosters. Your thoughts about that?
Well, I think we've long awaited this. The Europeans have been doing this for a while. They've been mixing their AstraZeneca vaccine with Pfizer mRNA vaccines. I think there are really good data now to support doing this, especially in some of the vaccines like J&J, which just with one shot seems to have a slightly lower effectiveness, and the presence of the mRNA vaccine really boosts up the antibodies for people. So I'm very excited about this. I think it'll be a great thing for people that have had the J&J. They can go out and get a Moderna or a Pfizer vaccine to kind of add a little extra oomph to their antibodies there. And I think it'll be it's an important thing. The data, again, looks very good, and I think that it will really help us secure some better protection as we move forward into the holidays.
Now, you anticipate that around the end of this week, we'll likely get that advice from the CDC?
I think so. That's sort of been the pattern. I think they're kind of right on the verge of doing that. Usually the Thursday meeting, they'll discuss it with the Advisory Council of Immunization Practices, and then I suspect Dr. Walensky will go ahead and make the announcement. And we kind of have been expecting this. So, again, I think it will be a good opportunity for the J&J folks. It is for this booster. I think they're going to open it up for anybody over 18 who's received the J&J to go ahead and proceed with either a Pfizer or a Moderna supplement.
Well, and interesting, because with both Pfizer and Moderna, 6 months is the recommendation for the interval after the second dose. But in the case of J&J, it's anyone after 2 months.
That's right. And I think, again, you know, they J&J was designed as a two-part vaccine. And because the efficacy was pretty good at a time when we were sort of trying to get as many people vaccinated as possible, they sort of dropped it down. But the truth is that it does appear that the immunity begins to wane a little bit faster with the J&J, and they need that extra lift from the mRNA vaccines.
Is there anybody for whom you would recommend getting a second J&J vaccine if they've gotten the first of that versus getting a dose of either Moderna or Pfizer?
Well, I think in the United States we have the luxury of recommending switching over to an mRNA vaccine, and I think the data supports doing that. You get just a much better response. So I would at this point probably recommend that most people get an mRNA booster. But if they only have access to another J&J, then that certainly is reasonable. And again, if you look at the data, when J&J was a two-part vaccine series, it's pretty good. So, you know, any vaccine at this point is a good thing to protect you from the disease. But I think we are learning kind of how to use these vaccines a little bit better, and the data is beginning to support that.
And again, there may be some who are still a little bit skittish about the newer technology in the mRNA vaccines, so maybe they have a preference for the conventional J&J that's been tried and true with so many different vaccines.
That's true. This is an adenovirus-based vaccine. The only caveat to that, Larry, is that it is with J&J that we've seen this very rare but very serious side effect of the clotting problem. So it's not my favorite vaccine to recommend for especially young women because of that risk. So there may be some added safety data by switching over to an mRNA vaccine for the boost.
All right. We're with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, and she awaits your questions, which you can ask via email at atcomments@kpecc.org. Please include your location and your first name. You can tweet at AirTalk. You can also post a question on our AirTalk Facebook page, or you can call us at 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC with your question for Dr. Schreiner. Also wanted to talk with you about some interesting findings on tuberculosis, that it appears TB is spread through fine droplets like COVID-19, which is different than what was previously thought, Dr. Schreiner?
Well, we've known for a long time that TB is an aerosolized pathogen. I think we, you know, there's many things that have come out of this pandemic, Larry, that are really of enormous benefit in terms of our understanding of how infectious diseases are spread and the physics and dynamics of especially aerosolized pathogens like viral pathogens and tuberculosis. But TB has long been known to be an airborne disease. In our hospital, we put patients with suspected tuberculosis in negative pressure rooms, and those individuals were people that we would always wear an N95, even before we had the COVID pandemic. So it's well known that they can have infectious aerosolized particles. There have been some animal data that was done way back in the days of the VA with looking at animals that were placed in ventilation areas, and they could see that TB was easily spread through aerosolized droplets. So that's been known. But I think the actual dynamics of it now is really coming to a better understanding and how to protect ourselves. And again, you know, tuberculosis, about a quarter of the planet is infected with TB. So it's a very, very significant infectious disease.
These South African researchers, their work quoted in the New York Times, have their finding that as much as 90% of TB bacteria released from someone infected with tuberculosis may be carried in tiny droplets called aerosols that are expelled with deep exhalation. You don't have to be coughing to spread that to someone else. And that's similar to COVID-19, right?
Absolutely. Again, the dynamics of aerosolized infectious pathways is really being studied very carefully now, and both of these pathogens float around in the air and are suspended in the air, even with relatively minor activities of the person who has the disease, and that's been well described with tuberculosis. And I think we just have a better understanding now in using COVID as a model for how aerosols are transmitted.
Dr. Schreiner, what do you think about people using antigen tests before they get together for holiday gatherings? You know, should you sit in your car before you get out to go into someone's house, take an antigen test, or before you walk into Thanksgiving dinner? Is that a good precaution to take?
Well, you know, the antigen tests are a tool. They're not as accurate, obviously, as the gold standard, which are nasopharyngeal swabs, PCR swabs. Some of them are better than others. I think that this is an area that, again, we're going to see improvement, and we are seeing that already in some novel techniques to do assessment for SARS-CoV-2. Right now, the home antigen kits are not very accurate, and, you know, it's a pretty big mistake if you get a negative antigen test and then you go into an event where you're unmasked for indoors for a prolonged period of time, and that's when you can have transmission. So I do think that the better and safer course is to continue to use good masking and social distancing, unless you want to get a nasopharyngeal swab beforehand if you're going into a place, especially if they have high-risk individuals. I think the unfortunate death of General Powell yesterday speaks to why we have to have herd immunity, because so many individuals, though they chose to be vaccinated, were not protected because their immune systems couldn't respond. And so it is the responsibility of all of us who do have healthy immune systems to protect them by getting immunized and taking the appropriate precautions.
Could it also be in the case of Colin Powell that there were that he was just so frail that what would have typically been a mild case in someone else just because of that frailty proved to be fatal?
It certainly could be. Myeloma and CLL are both some of the hematologic malignancies. These are individuals that don't do well with COVID. And so it doesn't surprise me that, unfortunately, he didn't survive it. But again, protection and prevention is the most important thing for those individuals who may not have responded to a vaccine. And he, of course, was scheduled to get his booster, but unfortunately, he was exposed before that could happen.
We're talking with Huntington Hospital's Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. She directs infectious disease and prevention at Huntington, and we have her for one more segment with your questions at atcomments@kpcc.org. You can also call us at 866-893-5722, tweet at AirTalk, or post on the AirTalk Facebook page. We get the questions, whichever of those four methods that you use to ask them. Coming up a little bit later this hour on AirTalk, it's the Triple Play with Nick Roman of All Things Considered, A. Martinez of Morning Edition, and me. We'll talk Dodger baseball as just a few hours away from Game 3.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, where she directs infectious disease and prevention, that program at Huntington. She, of course, infectious disease specialist. And we're taking your questions at atcomments@kpcc.org. Please include your location and your first name. Ivy in Altadena wants to ask about AstraZeneca and its request for emergency use authorization of an antibody cocktail to help deal with COVID-19. You've also got Merck, of course, which has a pill that it's seeking approval for. I'll let you pronounce Molnupiravir or something like that, that would be a treatment for COVID. Dr. Schreiner, what are the promise in the AstraZeneca and Merck technologies?
Well, I think it's nice to have different tools now to maybe prevent COVID, which the Molnupiravir medication that Merck has could possibly do. It would behave something like oseltamivir or Tamiflu for influenza. The monoclonal antibodies, a lot of drug companies are making them for COVID, and they work fairly well. But again, they're very difficult to use. They're intravenous. You have to have a nurse who does it, place an IV catheter. They can be done at home, but it requires a home health nursing. They're very, very expensive. So I think there's a real need to have more oral agents that are effective both in treating mild COVID, starting it right away when you first test positive or have some symptoms, and perhaps using it post-exposure prophylaxis. That's another utility for those kind of medications. And then finally, using it in people who are at very high risk for developing COVID. So I think that those are important tools moving forward. Pfizer is developing an oral medication kind of based on the HIV medications. It's a protease inhibitor. And Atea and Roche pharmaceutical companies have come together to also produce another oral medication. So it's good news. We've been waiting a very long time for this. Monoclonal antibodies have their place, but I think inexpensive and easily accessible oral therapy that's safe and effective is going to be a huge step forward.
Catherine in West Los Angeles says, in the reporting on Colin Powell's death, there was mention of the drugs that treat Parkinson's disease and that they could suppress the immune system. And Catherine wants to know if that's true.
Well, any medications can. Some of the medications we use in Parkinson's can sometimes alter the dynamics of the white blood cell count. That's very uncommon. The more important disease that he had was multiple myeloma, and that is a B-cell cancer. And those individuals have very significant risks for infection of many different types, and so especially viral infections. And so that was probably the more important disease that contributed to his unfortunate death. So I think that, again, this is, these patients are also receiving medications, the treatment for multiple myeloma can affect the white blood cells, and so that was probably more of a factor, but it just reinforces the responsibility of all of us who are healthy to protect those individuals and keep them from getting exposed to COVID.
Eric tweets at AirTalk, very related to this, my father has advanced Parkinson's. He's fully vaccinated and has a booster. How cautious do I need to be around him to make sure he isn't in danger?
Well, you know, people that are elderly and fragile are very high risk for this. Even just age itself, if you take away all of the other comorbidities, advanced age can be a risk factor for acquiring disease and not doing very well. So we, again, want to pay attention to our elderly citizens and protect them. And this is something to keep in mind as we move into the holidays, is that the desire to be together for the holidays and to spend time with our loved ones, you still want to really think about if you have an elderly parent in a closed indoor area, that there could be some risk for bringing the disease in. And even though they had been vaccinated, they can get a COVID and have a bad outcome.
We have Anita tweeting at AirTalk, should Moderna booster for a J&J first dose recipient be the half dose Moderna booster or a full Moderna Moderna dose like people got with shot one or two? Oh my.
It's a lot of words there.
And I'm asking for people to send money to contribute. Who would pay after hearing that, that mangling of a question? At least not that listener.
I mean, and you're very facile at handling medical terminology, Larry, so I'm sure that people are very appreciative.
Thank you.
I think that the Moderna booster will be the half dose that's recommended. I haven't seen any data that they want to use the full dose. And I just want to make a comment, a personal comment, as I received my booster yesterday, and I had about 2.5 hours of shaking chills last night.
Ooh.
But that's your immune system responding. And so I wanted to say that so that people aren't alarmed if that happens when they get their third shot, whether it's a Pfizer or Moderna. It's a normal thing. It's your immune system. I feel much better now. A Tylenol is a very good thing to take when you're having that. It just was pretty impressive. So.
Yeah, I had that couple of hours of that intense shivering. And after my second Moderna shot, and my wife just piled a bunch of blankets on top of me, which was very helpful. And then it passed, you know, so it was weird. It's almost, I could almost just feel it passing quickly, like it had gone through me. Nothing that I can really compare it to that I've ever experienced before.
Yeah, that's your immune system responding to the vaccine, and that's a good thing. That means you're going to be, you know, better protected. And yeah, the cat decided to sit on my head because I was kind of warm from a fever. So I think he was getting the chills and a fever at the same time. So
they're very creative that way. 866-893-5722. You can also ask your question via email at atcomments@kpcc.org. Let's see. We have Meredith from Pasadena, who posts on our AirTalk Facebook page, I'd love to hear a projected timeline for kids 5 to 11 being eligible for the Pfizer vaccine. Dr. Schreiner?
Well, I think it's coming. I think that we're looking at that very carefully. I think that will be the next thing on the docket, probably next week. You can just see that each week there's sort of a development, and it goes through the FDA for EUA approval, and then it's transferred to the CDC, and they make the recommendation. So I think it's coming, and I think that will be a great relief to parents and school teachers, and it will protect our kids. Severe COVID is not real common in children, but it's common enough, and any child that dies of COVID is a preventable death, not to mention they're very effective transmitters of disease. So it's a very, very important move forward, and I think that probably in the next couple of weeks we'll be expecting that. They want to be very careful looking at the dosing and the potential side effects, but right now it looks very good.
I've seen a number of people end up with colds during this season, and I was wondering about testing. At what point, when people start experiencing symptoms that could be cold or flu, should they get a test? Is it, you know, when you sniffles or have the first sneeze? At what point?
Well, that's the big problem, Larry, and we want to make sure that if people have some type of symptoms, you know, a runny nose, certainly if they lose their sense of taste or smell, they're having a little bit of a dry cough, they may attribute it to sinusitis. you know, if they're kind of carrying on their day and they're really not exposed to anybody that they could potentially transmit it to, then, you know, maybe they don't need to get tested. But tests are widely available now, and I do encourage people to do that, because we certainly want people that are living in congregate living situations and nursing homes or on college campuses to get tested. They may do fine with COVID, but they could easily transmit it to someone who loses their life. And that's really, again, you don't want to have to live with that thought. And so it's important that people, if they're suspicious that they have something infectious, they should get tested. If you have a cold or influenza, you shouldn't go to work, and spreading it to your coworkers is just as bad.
Christine in Santa Ana says, I've had both of my shots. I'm immunocompromised. I double mask, generally do all I can. I don't believe all these people running around without masks are actually all fully vaccinated. I don't know how or when we're going to get out of this. Well, Christine, a couple of things to keep in mind. California is now the only state that has seen its cases of COVID retreat to the moderate level, which is great news. And the other thing is that a lot of the people you're seeing are outdoors unmasked, and that part of that is our understanding more about how the virus is spread in just, you know, again, much smaller groups, not large outdoor gatherings. But Dr. Schreiner, you want to respond to Christine and her concerns that we're always going to be in this particular circumstance with COVID?
Well, I think especially as an immunocompromised person, for Christine, I think that it's important that she take the appropriate precautions. And we know that masking protects people. N95 or KN95 really can protect you from not just COVID, but influenza and, of course, tuberculosis, of which there's still plenty in L.A. County of that. So I think that it's important that you know, if you feel comfortable doing that sort of thing, then you should. I agree with Christina that there's people that are out there that are not fully vaccinated or are partially vaccinated. And we know that fully vaccinated people can transmit the disease as well. So we do need to be cautious. I'm hopeful, cautiously optimistic that we are maybe not at the end, but perhaps at the beginning of the end. And that if we can get through the next few months without a major surge, at least in California, that will be in better shape. But it's going to be a little while, and we're going to have recurrent bouts of this for many years, probably.
All right. Laker games resuming with tonight's season opener at Staples Center against the Warriors. Your thoughts briefly about people returning to, you know, large-scale indoor events like this. They'll have to be fully vaccinated at Staples, but what do you think?
It makes me a little nervous, Larry, because I think, you know, we know that vaccinated people can still transmit the disease. I would, you know, to be extra safe, wear a mask. You know, you can yell quite effectively with a mask on and cheer on your team, and I think that's the safer thing to do. You know, don't take it down for long periods of time. You want to eat some of the delicious food that they have at the Laker games. You know, do it quickly. But we're not out of the woods yet, and I just worry about, as we move forward into the holidays, we may see more disease.
All right. Let's hope that people are cautious. And we thank you, as always, Dr. Schreiner. So appreciate you being with us. And our regards to you and all of your colleagues at Huntington. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Larry.
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Director of Infectious Disease and Prevention at Huntington Hospital in Pasadena.
Support comes from Japan House LA presenting Yes, Kawaii is Art. Express yourself. Kawaii translates to cute or adorable, yet its influence extends beyond aesthetics to encompass fashion, art, technology, and even social behavior. Sebastian Masuda, the king of kawaii, brings together multiple artworks unraveling the kawaii concepts to foster a sense of joy, innocence, and community as a tool for self-expression and representation. Visitors can step into this colorful world to feel the aesthetic for themselves. May 2nd to November 3rd. No admissions fee. More at japanhousela.com.
Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Back together, the triple play with Nick Roman, A. Martinez, yours truly, as we talk Dodger baseball with our guys down 2-0 to the Atlanta Braves. Game 3 this afternoon at 2 o'clock on TBS, as is the entire series. A, let me start with you. And, you know, the Dodger front office is getting tremendous blame for how they've handled pitchers, not just in the first two games here, but in the divisional series prior. Do you think it's justified?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, they can't be blameless in all this. I know that they're infinitely smarter than all three of us. I realize this. That's why they're there and we're where we're at. But at the same time, there's always something to be said for common sense. And sometimes things that have worked for decades and decades will still work in 2021, even if they seem old-fashioned. I don't understand bringing in Urias in the eighth inning of the game that they just lost. That didn't make any sense to me, especially when Blake Treinen barely broke a sweat in the seventh inning before Urias came in. I realize that these formulas and what they do has won them many, many games.
I think we just lost
a series contender, but sometimes common sense has to take over, and common sense hasn't been used in the first two games of the series against the Braves.
Well, and among the biggest criticisms is with Max Scherzer saying that he was tired in his last start, and of course he was used to close out in the divisional series. So, Nick, what do you think?
I have fewer problems with the pitching and a whole lot of problems with the hitting. The batter, you know, you don't even have to make all those decisions if the Dodger batters hit when runners are on and in scoring position. And, you know, in the games that they have lost by one run in the playoffs, with runners in scoring position, they are 2-for-22. You get a base hit in any of those circumstances, and you don't have to worry about whether you're bringing in Julio Urias or whether Max Scherzer is tired or whether Blake Treinen has thrown only 9 pitches in an inning. You're just, you know, you're ahead by 4 or 5 runs. So my big problem is that they're just plain not hitting. And if they don't hit, they're not going to win. You know, that's the problem. You got Justin Turner right now who's hitting 107 in the playoffs, and Trey Turner is hitting 200, and A.J. Pollock, who's hitting 182. You fix any of that, and you don't have to worry about the pitching. Everything else falls into place.
Well, and it's not like they're facing, you know, one Cy Young winner after another also. I mean, the Braves have decent pitching, but not commensurate to the Dodgers' hitting response to it.
Well, the Braves are better than people might think. That bullpen is not bad, but still, you know, you have to do better than 2-for-22. And if you do, you know, then the Giants series is over in 4 games and doesn't go to 5. And this series is either tied at 1 or the Dodgers are up by 2. So, you know, I understand all of the, you know, maneuverings with pitchers. I kind of understand Urias coming in because Freddie Freeman, who's a left-hand hitter, was going to bat, and so did Jock Peterson. And in fact, he got those two guys out in that inning. He just didn't get any of the right-hand hitters out, and he didn't get out Eddie Rosario, the first of the left-hand hitters who got a base hit and ended up scoring. So, you know, all of those things kind of start to mix up. There are other things, too, that go into it. If Max Muncy isn't injured, then Steven Souza isn't playing right field, and a throw to the plate that almost got a runner would come up instead from Mookie Betts, and that runner wouldn't either not run or be thrown out. Mookie wouldn't be in center field. It would be Bellinger, and an outfield and a fly ball to the outfield that isn't caught might have been caught. So there are all kinds of things that go into it.
All right. Well, and of course, they did give up 5 runs in the last game. We know in playoffs that scoring is less than other times of the year. So I certainly hear what you're saying, Nick, that the hitting in clutch situations has been atrocious. But also, they're going to have to pitch better. And, you know, one of the things Ron Darling, the color announcer on TBS, keeps, you know, saying is that when you bring in so many different relief pitchers, everybody's got to be perfect. And you're increasing the odds in doing that someone's going to have an off game, and in a tight game, that's going to cost you that contest. What do you think, Nick?
Well, I think that, you know, that's absolutely true. The Dodgers have been running relief pitchers out there like Pony Express horses. Somebody's going to run out of gas after a while. So when you hear Max, you know, gee, I was just a little tired, or you see Kenley Jansen taking more pitches to get himself set up than usual. All of that kind of thing happens. But each team is doing that. You know, they're running a lot of guys out there. The Braves have run a lot of pitchers out there, too. Tonight could be different. I would expect that tonight would be different. You know, on the mound, you got Walker Buehler. And you notice that the Dodgers more or less have protected him. He's the one guy. I mean, they did run him on one day shorter than usual, but pulled him early against the Giants, and now he has full rest. And I would expect, because he's been asked to do this kind of thing before, win a game that absolutely has to be won. That's when you put Walker Buehler out there.
Well, and late in the game, you're probably going to have those shadows at Dodger Stadium since it's a 2 o'clock or 2:08 first pitch. So when those relievers get in late, that may be tough to hit.
Ideally, yeah, because that's the way Dodger Stadium is built and where the sun hits. Yeah, you've got the advantage if they have a lead. So that's the thing. I mean, they at this point down 2-0. Considering how good they can be when they play with a lead, I think they need to not wait around and figure out a way to scratch out something early. Whether it's going back to the old hit and run, stealing a base, and making sure that runner gets over to home plate, you get that lead. Some way, somehow, give Walker Buehler a 1-0 lead after one, and I'd feel a lot better about things. But because if they're playing catch up in the sixth and seventh inning, then those bullpens come into play again, and I don't know if I trust the Dodgers bullpen to hold the lead or the Dodgers hitters to get to the Atlanta bullpen.
We have the Dodger lineup that's just been released, and we're going to have, Justin Turner back at third base after that stinger kept him out last game, at least out of the starting lineup. Gavin Lux in center field. Cody Bellinger will be at first base. Chris Taylor in left field. So the outfield with Chris Taylor in left, Gavin Lux in center, Mookie Betts in right, and the infield will feature Bellinger at first, Trey Turner at second, Corey Seager at shortstop, Justin Turner at third, and Will Smith behind the plate, Walker Buehler, of course, we said, on the mound. So, not particularly a surprise there with the lineup.
No. It's just Matt Edwards does with the lineup and does is moving along. That's I mean, what he puts out there before the game begins is usually not what we talk about after the fact.
It's
what happens
point in
between and at the end of the game and who's hitting and in what spot and who's pitching in what spot. That's typically what we talk about more.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So, are you feeling optimistic with Buehler on the mound today?
Yeah, and that's the only reason. That's the only reason. Believe me, the last couple of days, guys, the pessimist has been creeping back. But knowing that Buehler's on the mound gives me that little shred of optimism. But I can't stress it enough. Give Buehler a lead, whatever you can do, to make sure that when the second inning begins, the Dodgers have one straight number on the board and the Braves have a round number on the board. That to me, will make the entire difference for the Dodgers starting to claw their way
you're
back.
You're breaking up, unfortunately, but Nick, and it would help if the Dodgers stop chasing pitches out of the strike zone.
Yeah, it's the same thing they did against the Giants in game one of that best of five series. If you're looking for hopeful signs, here's a couple. The Dodgers haven't been down 0-3 in a seven-game playoff series in 55 years. They have come back from down two games three times since I've been a baseball fan, and one of them was last year against this same Braves team.
All right. Thank you so much, Nick Roman. You'll hear him this afternoon with Drive Time, all things considered at 4 o'clock, where he'll probably be keeping an eye on the game as he's doing his updates on ATC. And, of course, A. Martinez, you hear on NPR's Morning Edition. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us on this Tuesday. You remember back during the height of the pandemic when schools were closed, and so kids were being instructed online for hours each day. Well, that's largely gone away with the full reopening of public schools here in the Golden State. For those who are, physically compromised place where it would be dangerous for them to go back to school, the option that's available now is independent study. Now, that's been around for many years. Independent study is, as the name implies, highly independent. And this was mainly for kids who worked as professional actors or things like that, where they couldn't work and also go to school at the same time. But with independent study, for those who are not returning to school because of COVID concerns, it's become very difficult to try and replicate what they've done in their studies back when they had all those hours of online instruction, because this is far more independent. And for students who have special needs, difficult for them to get the same services provided at a distance as they would receive in person on campus. That's led a group of families to file a class action complaint that alleges the students at high risk of COVID who can't attend in person for safety reasons are not getting the degree of support that they need in independent study. With us, senior reporter at EdSource, who's been following the lawsuit, Carolyn Jones. Carolyn, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it very much. So share with us, first of all, how districts have been responding to these parental complaints.
Well, it's really it really varies across the state from district to district. Some districts have been really doing an outstanding job with this and really going the extra mile to make sure that students with disabilities are getting the services they need. And then for some districts, I mean, I don't think it's ill intent or anything like that, but they're just overwhelmed with a million other things going on right now with students returning to the classroom and safety protocols and trying to catch kids up with learning loss and so forth, that students with disabilities have kind of fallen through the cracks a little bit. And so that was kind of the impetus for this complaint with the U.S. Department of Justice.
Carolyn, back again when schools were closed, many of these services were provided remotely. My wife, a speech pathologist in a public school, and so her caseload was, she delivered her services online to the students that were on her caseload. She and, of course, and the vast majority of students are now back on campus. But I was just wondering, for those students who were not able to return for health reasons but still need those types of services, are they not being rendered remotely?
Well, it really depends. I think the issue is that, you know, students with disabilities have these things called IEPs, individual education programs, which sort of map out their own individual education goals. And unless independent study is written into those IEPs, the students aren't getting them. And so there's just a huge backlog right now. And, you know, parents are understandably very upset. Some students have not received any education at all since schools reopened in August, not in person or virtual. So it's just been, you know, it's just this huge equity problem right now, particularly for students with cognitive or developmental disabilities who can't wear masks, or, you know, online learning is really a challenge for them. And who really, really need those extra services. It's just been a huge problem so far.
Also with us is Sonia Smith, Director of Student Support Services for the LA County Office of Education. Sonia, thank you very much for being with us. So how are different districts in the county responding to the delivery of special services to students at home?
The different districts, it really depends. As you mentioned, other panelists mentioned, it's really about the IEP. That's what really drives the services for the students. So it is a great challenge to make sure that the IEP team comes together and it is what is in the best interest of the student to provide the educational benefit. So it really is an individual decision. It's not something that you can say that the districts are just following this program, because it's, as you know, a federally based mandate.
All right. Carolyn, what does this lawsuit actually call for the districts to do? Accelerate IEPs or what?
Well, it's a complaint. You know, it's asking the state to take a more active role in this, because both the state and the federal government have come out recently, you know, just reminding districts, you know, you have to get on top of this. You have to make sure that kids with disabilities are getting educated right now. And so they want the state to really be more proactive. You know, the state has been very clear about this, that this has to happen. These IEPs have to get updated. This has to be happening right now. So it's just, I mean, that's what they're asking for, basically, is the state to take a stronger role.
But if the challenge is in getting the IEPs put together and those meetings taking places with the families, how would the state intervene? What would they do?
Well, that is a very good question. And I think, you know, I think it's a question of accountability, you know, trying to find out which districts are lagging on this and then just, you know, talk to them, try to make this happen, try to expedite it somehow. It's, you know, I mean, right now it's kind of on the honor system. I mean, districts are told this is what we would like you to do. And then some are right on it and some are, you know, it's not a priority. So it's just a question of just really finding out which districts those are and just talking to them, finding out what the obstacles are, and maybe trying to fix the obstacles. Do they need more staff? Maybe get them more staff.
And Sonia Smith of LA County Office of Education, is there any option with some of these districts for the provision of these disability services or educational services to be done in home?
That is certainly a potential, but it all goes back to the IEP team and how they can deliver services, and staffing is a huge issue as well. You know, even just to staff the independent study programs themselves, districts are having a difficult time. And then certainly the specialized programs, you know, there was a shortage even before this. So it's tough to, again, make a general call for the county.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things I was seeing, I think, is that LA Unified, for the teachers who are not getting vaccinated, that they might be reassigned to do the independent study support and to provide a bit more of that than typical independent study gets, so that students would have like a daily check-in with their teacher, and they need more to even do that, as I understand. But Sonia, do you know anything about how that is progressing to try and beef up staffing for independent study?
I just know that districts are scrambling. You know, and there are some districts that have, you know, potentially hired staff to provide some intervention services, but they're currently providing independent study instruction. So they're in a waiting period to replace that independent study program first.
I'd love to hear from parents if you have a child who is not able to go back to school for health reasons because of vulnerability, or maybe there's someone in the household who's particularly vulnerable to COVID-19, and so it's not safe for that family member to have the child go back to school. I'd like to hear how that's played out for you, particularly if your student is someone who requires special services from your local school. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. You can also email us with your comment at atcomments@kpecc.org. Please include your location and your first name. You can also post on our AirTalk Facebook page, or you can tweet at AirTalk. Again, I'm looking for you. If you, your family is in this circumstance, maybe you're awaiting one of these individualized educational plans, an IEP to be performed. You're trying to meet with the team at your school and get these services. I'd be very interested in hearing how this has progressed or not, and your perspective on any impediments. And if you work in a district where this has really been a problem providing these services, I'd be interested in your take on this from the school or district perspective. Once again, 866-893-KPECC, or you can comment at atcomments@kpecc.org, including your location and your first name. We'll continue with Carolyn Jones, reporter for EdSource, and Sonia Smith of the LA County Office of Education, and a third guest who'll be joining us momentarily.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're getting word that the L.A. City Council is expected to vote tomorrow on whether to suspend Councilman Mark Ridley Thomas from office. Ridley Thomas was indicted last week on federal bribery and conspiracy charges stemming from his time on the County Board of Supervisors. Again, we're receiving word that a vote is expected from the L.A. City Council tomorrow on whether Mark Ridley Thomas will be suspended by his colleagues on the council. Right now, we're talking about the challenge in delivering special services to students who are home, not able for health reasons, either they're experiencing or family members are, so they're getting their education as a part of the independent study program at their local school. With us is Claudia Center, legal director for the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, which is one of the groups who filed the complaint in this case. Claudia, thank you for being with us. Share with us what remedy you want.
Sure. So Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund and our co-counsel, Disability Rights California, we've received complaints from families across the state who have children with disabilities who can't return to in-person education because they have autism, intellectual disabilities, asthma, respiratory illnesses, autoimmune disabilities. Some of these children struggle to wear a mask consistently, and these children are at home with no educational placement whatsoever. Well, the state of California has enacted a law and instructed school districts that they must offer an at-home option, the independent study, to every family except for children with IEPs. So we just think that's fundamentally unfair that children who need an at-home option the most, these children with significant disabilities at risk from COVID, are the ones that are not being given an at-home education option.
Well, not being given that option, does that mean that the services just are going unprovided?
Yes, for many of our families, the children are at home with no educational placement whatsoever. Some of our families are actually facing charges of truancy. So it's quite a dire situation across the state for a group of very vulnerable students.
So they're facing truancy charges because the school believes the students need to be on campus instead of at home? Or how would that be?
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Children should come in person and be in school, and the families do not feel it's safe for the children with these particular conditions, making them at high risk from COVID.
Okay. And so it sounds like then there are California districts who are not giving the latitude that, you know, many of them in Southern California are, that if the parents feel the students need to stay home, that they're able to do so.
Yeah, we've encountered a lot of problems from school districts saying, you're not eligible to join independent study, or if you want to join independent study, you may, but you have to waive your rights to all of the services in your IEP. And so it's really putting families in an untenable situation.
Also joining us is Kirsten Nielsen, who's a parent of a 9-year-old son who has been excluded from independent study. Thank you very much for joining us, Kirsten. Please describe for us briefly the case of your son.
Thank you for having me. In his case, he also has not had schooling for, I believe we're going on seven weeks. And we were told a week before school started that the independent study option that was going to be offered to all of these students would not apply to my child. So 7 days before school started, we're scrambling trying to figure out something. We wanted to have an IEP, and again, we're told that that was something we were not going to be able to have prior to school starting, and that they had 30 days to get back to us on that. We requested that immediately and still have not had an IEP to date. And he still has no schooling.
So this was even with the 30-day guarantee, and they didn't meet that?
Correct.
Have they explained why?
No, I have not had any contact from them. Not about that.
Okay. And so have your calls just gone unreturned, or what happens is you've reached out to the district?
They keep requiring different things. So initially they offered me a home health option. And if I got a letter from my doctor, then we would be able to get that. And I specifically asked, okay, well, if I do that, is he going to still receive his services? Because I didn't see how that was going to be any different than the home option, which Claudia mentioned. They are telling you have to forego all of your services if you choose that. So he assured me, this was the counselor from the school, assured me that, no, if you get the letter from your doctor, you know, just confirming his health condition, then he would be able to receive the services along with the home health option. And I got the letter and then was told that, oh, well, now you need to apply through the actual nurse's office for this. And I'm like, well, this was offered to me. I wasn't, you know, applying for this. This is what you told me was going to be accommodating my son's needs. But they just keep giving you different things that you need to do in order to supposedly get the education. And here we are. I gave them that letter that started, and I've still not gotten any services for him.
And during the time where all students were home, did your son receive his services remotely during that time?
Virtually last year, yes. And he did great on it. And his teachers at the beginning of this school year, the special education or special services teachers, all told me through email that they would agree to do his studies virtually, because they had not been informed by the district, even though I had already, that they were not going to be allowed to offer their services that way.
Now, he's had an IEP under which his education has been provided previously, right?
Yes, he's had an IEP since.
Have they told you that he needs a new one to do the independent study route or not?
No, they just told me that we would have to apply to have the independent study, and that all services that are currently offered in his IEP would no longer be offered. We would have to forego all of them and basically waive his rights to any of those services to have independent study.
And Claudia Center of the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, has that been the way it was pre-pandemic, that students on independent study had no access to any of these services?
In the past, this is Claudia, in the past there were independent study options with services, but there did need to be advocacy to get the services in independent study, and now we just have such a larger group of students who need an at-home educational option. And we also have a lot more experience. The school districts know how to do this, so we think the state should take a lot more leadership and really be directive with the districts that they need to offer an at-home education option for these students.
Well, is part of the problem that you had the legislature setting up the only other option to in-person independent study, this sort of longer-standing way of having education that is not a daily sort of intensive like online education was at the height of the pandemic? So you don't have now for those students anything really comparable to what they were getting a year ago?
Yes, that's true. The legislature caused this problem in large degree by creating an option that's guaranteed to students without IEPs, but is not permitted or not guaranteed for students with IEPs. But the state of California could use its oversight authority to direct school districts to comply with the ADA and the IDEA and provide an appropriate at-home education for students who need to be at home with IEPs.
And Kirsten Nielsen, what would resolve this for you? What would you want to see your school do?
I think for us, it would be great if they could offer the program the way they did last year virtually. If the teachers are willing to do that, And in my son's case, it really worked for him. I think that would be great. I would be happy with that.
But it sounds like under the current state law that the straight education part of this is not available, that the school could not do that. Is that your understanding?
As of right now, yes, that's what they're saying. They're not able to do that.
Okay. Sonia Smith of the L.A. County Office of Education, is that true that the districts just under the law can't do that?
No, not quite. They can provide independent study for a student with disabilities, but it has to be agreed upon with the IEP team. So that's a challenge. And, you know, with independent studies, it's been around for about 30 years, but it typically is a very short-term thing, from 5 days to, you know, usually a month or so, where a student might be traveling or, you know, something along that line. And so this notion where students are on independent study for very long periods of time is very new. And then the legislation also added new requirements for any student who's participating in independent study for 15 days or more in a school year.
All right. I want to thank you all for being with us. That's Sonia Smith, Direct Student Support Services for the L.A. County Office of Education. Carolyn Jones, senior reporter at EdSource, who's been following the lawsuit and the complaint that was filed. Claudia Center, one of the co-complainants on this, a legal director for the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. And parent Kirsten Nielsen, whose 9-year-old son has been excluded from independent studies, gone weeks without getting his regular education. It's Air Talk on KPCC. I love these backbone segments of Air Talk where I get to talk with my colleagues and you get to hear from them about the work that they do. I'm going to first introduce a man who I worked extremely closely with for a number of years because he was the engineer of Air Talk and did just a wonderful, wonderful job. He's audio production engineer for KPCC, Sean Campbell. Sean, thank you so much, and it's great to have you as a guest on the show today, not just see you on the other side of the glass.
It's good to be on. It's very weird, I have to say, but yeah.
Well, and I said in introduction, these are people you don't hear on the air, but in your case, that's actually not true because listeners do hear your voice doing some of the acknowledgments or station IDs, things like that. Mm-hmm. How's that been for you? Have any friends recognized that that's you on the air?
Well, the friends have heard me before on the air in different environments, but so yeah, they kind of, you know, very well versed in giving me the business for when they hear me.
So you mentioned being on the air, but you're at KPCC. Most of what you're doing is a behind the scenes thing. What attracts you to this work of audio production?
It's really, you know, it started out just I liked twiddling knobs and pushing faders and making lights blink and stuff like that. It was really just you know, like playing with toys. And recording was something that I discovered as a kid with my dad's cassette recorders, and that was just a constant source of fascination for me, recording things and playing them back. And I never intended this to become a career, but people kept paying me to play with their toys, so I kept going.
Well, and you're currently mixing a morning edition with Suzanne mm-hmm. Watley. How are those early mornings going?
Oh boy. Well, that's another story. Having an alarm set at 2:30 in the morning is kind of ridiculous.
That's a challenge. Yeah, absolutely.
But Suzanne's great to work with, and it's, you know, it can be a fun show.
She did, definitely. Yeah. How'd you happen to come to KPCC?
Oh boy. Well, I started working in radio where I grew up in Anchorage, Alaska. Got into public radio up there for working with the statewide network, APRN. It was APRN at the time. My sister actually saw an ad for a job for an NPR engineer, and she told me about it. And I applied thinking, there's no way I'm going to get this. And they called me at like 5:30 in the morning because they forgot about the whole time zone difference between DC and Alaska. And yeah, they were interested. And I flew to D.C., interviewed, and I got the job, to my great surprise. Stayed at NPR for about 10 years and was working in Culver City.
At NPR West.
Right. And kind of a sad day. They had a whole slew of layoffs, and I was one of those lucky people. So I was filling in at Marketplace for a little while and back at NPR, and job came open here for our Crawford Family Forum. Back before all this crazy pandemic stuff was going on, we had a lot of events here. They were looking for a technical director to run that, and I applied for that. I was not the ideal candidate for that job, but there were some board op positions open, so I took one of those, and I stuck around because I liked it.
Well, that's great. And you've been here, what, about 10 years?
Yeah, just about 10 years. Yep.
We're talking with Sean Campbell, KPCC audio production engineer, a member of our essential workforce here, the backbone of KPCC. And having worked so closely with Sean for a number of years, he is an extraordinarily talented person, as is Parker, our current engineer on Air Talk. I'm very, very fortunate to work with engineers of just extraordinary dedication and talent. Also with this, KPCC Finance Project Manager Bob Garcia. Bob, it's great to have you with us as our backbone guest today. Tell us what you do in this job, please.
Well, Larry, I work with our accounts payable section. I also work with our grants team for funding, and any special projects that happen to come up that are finance related, I handle that. And I can also say that, you know, we also look at everybody who has donated and if we've met those challenges. If we don't meet those challenges, we cannot push that through. So I can verify that. I've had to deny some challenges from going through into our banks.
And that's tough, definitely, when we can't fulfill a challenge, definitely. Now, you've also been here almost a decade.
Yeah, I have. It doesn't seem that long, but it has.
And it was through a temp agency that you connected with KPCC?
Yeah, I had left the job that I was at, and I was like looking for something different. And they were trying to find something else for me, but this had popped through as a temporary until they could find something. And it was for KPCC because one of the staff members had gone on leave. So I worked there and I really enjoyed it and I enjoyed the people. And they let me know a couple years later that they had an opening. So I applied and I got the job. So, and it's been great.
And you found that you really like working in the nonprofit sector. What is it about that, and particularly KPCC, that you love?
Well, you know, you really have to believe in what the company does for nonprofits. And before I worked here, I worked for a nonprofit newspaper for many years. And this really just felt like home when I was temping here. So, it really felt like a place for me to go and work at. And it's proved to be that case, you know, like they say, you know, if you really enjoy what you're doing, it doesn't feel like work.
We're talking with Bob Garcia, KPCC Finance Project Manager. I should also mention that Bob went to high school with my wife, Kristen, at Mark Keppel High in Alhambra. So it's fun when they actually saw each other at one of our KPCC social gatherings many years ago and remembered each other from high school. Bob, also, you started to touch on this, but how much listener support means to KPCC's budget. You've really seen its significance close up, and elaborate on that, please.
Yes, Larry. It's people don't believe that we really say that, you know, the listeners really do help support us in getting our jobs done. But 2/3 of our revenue comes from public support, from new people that are calling in, large donors, small donors. So every little bit always helps. And it's great. It's great to be able to say stuff like that, that, you know, that we really are supported by our listeners.
All right. And you're a big Dodger fan, I know, Bob. So at 2:00, you probably have your attention divided between work and the Dodger game, I'm assuming.
Yeah, the TV will be on. The sound will be a little low, but I'll still be working.
All right. Well, Bob, I just want to thank you for all the terrific work you and your teammates in finance do. Because, you know, in any organization like this, this is often work that's unheralded, but extremely important, and where the accuracy and dedication is just invaluable, makes a huge difference in the organization. So on behalf of all your colleagues, I just want to thank you and the other members of the finance team for all that you do to support what we do on the air. It's huge.
Yes, yes. We have a great finance team.
All right. Bob Garcia, KPCC Finance Project Manager. And let me just go back to Sean Campbell, KPCC Audio Production Engineer, as we close. So, Sean, what is your favorite, just briefly, type of production work that you get to do here?
Oh, boy. I really like being live. I like being where Parker is right now. This
that
is
that pressure.
Yeah. I'm on the wrong side of the mic right now, and I know it. When the mic is on, I should be pushing faders. Other than that, our podcast work is picking up, and I love doing that, too.
All right. And they're different, I assume, because, as you say, you've got the live pressure when you're on the board doing Morning Edition, and then you're trying to get just that perfect mix for the podcast where you've got time for the perfectionist side to come out. Sean Campbell, thank you so much. Again, another invaluable member of our team at KPCC.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.